The Power of Art is an 8-part PBS series that attempts to capture and examine the history, meaning, and impact of art by focusing on 8 renowned artists and a single masterpiece of each. It's hosted by Simon Schama, the noted historian, who joins me now, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show. Hello.
Hello.
The last time we spoke, it was to discuss your book about slaves who fought with the British Army during the American Revolutionary War. There wasn't an artist in sight. But you've also written street art history. So do you see these as inextricably tied together, or are there? Do you just wear 2 different hats at different times?
I've been intellectually schizo for a long time, actually.
There are drugs.
I could put it, actually, in a more felicitous way, which I think I will. Namely that, actually, I first came to America to took a teaching job at Harvard in 1990 precisely because it let me do what Oxford University in its wisdom wouldn't let me do, and that's bring images and politics together. The first course I taught at Harvard in 1981 was called Art and Politics in 18th Century Europe. And it was while I was doing a Dutch book before that, you know, The Embarrassment of Riches, I thought, well, that I can't possibly write a book about Holland unless I treat images as a kind of language, not just paintings either, but engraved glasses, prints, even painted tiles. Then I had one of those reading moments that you've had a lot, Leonard, but this was, you know, Panofsky's Meeting in the Visual Arts. I know you've read that. And he put together for me what he called iconology, not just the decoding of symbols, but the sense in which a culture was comprised both of texts and images which talk to each other. And, you know, I mean, history without art seems to be a shriveled little thing that deals entirely with texts. But art that's, you know, without history is something which speaks only inside itself. So I suppose, you know, I spent a lot of time putting those two things together.
And some of the artists that you deal with reflect exactly what you've been talking about. We have Rembrandt here.
Right.
We have
David as well.
David. We have Titian, right. Turner, who goes back to the slave trade.
Right.
And you also have Picasso with the Guernica. Now that was one of the great treasures of New York City, and I almost regretted the death of Franco because that led to the painting being returned to Spain. One of my producers described seeing Guernica for the first time, and she said that as familiar as she was with the image, it didn't prepare her for the blow she felt experiencing the piece. Mm. And there is something about seeing art standing right in front of the painting.
Have you seen it in Spain right now?
No, I've only seen it here.
Yeah, I first saw it here, actually, in
but
the 60s.
But how do you... I mean, the TV is a problem, isn't it? Because it's hard enough to read a painting when you see it reproduced in a book. Yeah. But on TV, you're seeing it unless you have great high definition.
Yeah, we shot, actually... I wanted to make at least one film about sculpture, and one of these films is about Bernini, as you know. And we brought high-definition cameras to that, and you can buy very simple little jibs, articulated jibs. You can move in and out of sculptures in the most dramatically startling way. And we lit them very simply but very intensely, rather than a way I think you might have seen them in candlelight in Bernini's time. Paintings are absolutely, as you say, a problem. I think what we feel about paintings, there are certain things the cameras can do. It can. The Rembrandt film has a little sequence really about technique. And with really good lenses and really good cameramen, and we have both, you can expose details, especially something that's so brushy as Rembrandt is, that the naked eye, even if the guard would ever let you get that close, couldn't possibly actually perceive. In the end, though, what you can't do, exactly as you're saying, being in the physical presence of a work of art is incommensurable, long word that actually means something. So that part of the series is really to excite people enough to want to go and stand in the presence of these pictures themselves.
Well, you also say that art is meant to rip us from our default mode, and I've always thought that TV is our default mode.
Well, there you are. That's why I'm such a lucky boy, aren't I? Because actually BBC and PBS in their wisdom, so far touching all the wood that's around me, do let me do these things that actually represents the opposite, I hope, from white noise. People may love it or hate it, but it is meant to be a little jolt. And I chose works of art that I've nothing against art as the delivery of beauty. It's what the Greeks wanted thought art was defined as, beauty being a sort of visible approximation of a heavenly idea. But I chose works of art that, whether they were characteristic or not, and Guernica, as you know, Leonard, is incredibly uncharacteristic of Picasso's long time indifference to politics. But the works of art I chose are those which wanted to deliver sometimes a moral impact, or wanted to do something other than simply be decorative.
And some might argue that it would be good for the Guernica to be returned because the United States continues to need reminders of the horrors of war.
Did you see that? I just wanted to see that film because actually it ends. It's not, we broadcast it. It ends with that amazing moment outside Colin Powell's press conference when he'd done his, weapons of mass destruction. We now hollow, bitter laugh when we talk about it now. And I originally thought that it was the State Department people who found themselves in the corridor with a tapestry reproduction in the United Nations of Guernica and said, no, we can't do that, it's far too upsetting. But it wasn't, it was the media, actually, who said it's too distracting. And I say at the end, what a backhand compliment to the power of art, actually, that the 6 o'clock news can't be dealing with something like Guernica.
My guest is Simon Chamo, who is the host of and the writer of a series called The Power of Art, 8-part PBS series that began with back-to-back shows last week and continues today. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So how did you select these 8 artists? Are they personal favorites of yours? Because there's no Leonardo, there's no Michelangelo, no Giotto, no Masaccio, no Matisse, no Kandinsky, and I could go on and on and on.
There was a long list. Michelangelo, much too frightening, actually, I have to say. Why would Caravaggio not be frightening? I don't know. It's just that they had to fit, there's a certain artificiality about this. Of course, a lot of art, I don't need to tell you this, you know more frightening about art than almost anybody I know ostensibly.
Oh, stop it.
You do, outside the academy, you do. We've had these conversations before. But the series is not meant to say art is characteristically made at a moment of tortured high pressure. Of course not. There are all sorts of art is made in conditions of imperturbable serenity. But from Vasari's account of Michelangelo's, tussle with Julius II over his tomb, and partly because artists were, again, from Plato and Aristotle onwards, supposed to be the interlocutor between something celestial and something mortal, the sense of a kind of artist being a superman who might overreach is lodged in the literature. And what that literature does, however mythical it is give you little sort of dramas of problems in creativity. The great one early on, which I did want to do and was told no one's heard of him, you can't do it, is Benvenuto Cellini, because however much of a liar he was, as the first outrageously grandstanding autobiography written by a man under house arrest in his, 70s for doing unspeakable things, the story of the Perseus and Medusa that he sees as his answer to being condescended to by Michelangelo as a mere goldsmith. But he thinks he's about to die and takes to his sick bed, and they're about to cast this wonderful sculpture. And he thinks, well, I'm going to die, but nonetheless, it'll be there in the Loggia dei Lanzi, staring in a metallic way at Michelangelo's David. And he doesn't die. He's woken up, and they say, Master, the alloy is cooling. What are we going to do? And he throws the pots and pans on the fire. And I thought, well, it's not true. The romantics invent these moments of crisis. It's always there in the writing. So we artificially chose. What I wanted to do was find 8 stories that fitted without inventing anything, without top-loading anything, entirely documented as dramas that connect the times, the history, the artist's life, and the work. And that cuts the list down a bit.
But you also, I'm sure, had to choose artists who might have a certain popular appeal. You began the series with back-to-back segments on Van Gogh and on Picasso, and the Van Gogh was Wheatfields with Crows, which... I don't know if it's the last painting he ever painted, but according
we'll
to Lust for Life, it was.
Right,
I remember Kirk Douglas painting it.
We really don't know. It's close to the end, that's for sure.
So you did that because you knew that might draw people in?
Yes, in the BBC version, it wasn't. It was further on in the series. No, I tell you why I did that, actually, was because I think those last paintings, it's rather perverse of me in a way, are sometimes taken to be documents of his insanity. And I thought just the opposite.
That's just a beautiful painting.
Yes, they are. They're beautiful and incredibly daring. They do depart from perspective, and they're right at the moment of the invention of what we, you know, later was going to be thought of as expressionism. And I was also very much struck by, and I wanted to say the reason why he kills himself is to do with Theo disappearing and him panicking about his life support with his family and his money and so on. Also simply because of the letters to Theo, that I thought actually in this particular programme, the letters are so rich and they suggest not just somebody who is a strong feeler, but someone who's a very, very strong thinker too. And that if we found a really great actor, which we did with Andy Serkis, who wanted to do it, who's an amateur painter himself, Andy, we could actually make this very complicated, rather densely intellectual figure come to life, as well as simply just the tormented crazy.
Because you've done dramatizations and reenactments here.
We were slightly allergic to them. Originally, Claire Bevan and I, we said, well, we really don't want to have what Claire calls men with stick-on beards. But in two cases, in the case of Van Gogh and the case of Rothko, and some extent in Caravaggio, we actually have, particularly with Rothko, a set of statements that Rothko makes, and we thought that was worth trying out the possibility of an actor inhabiting Rothko's own persona. He's very sententious and very eloquent and self-consciously prophetic. In other places, we really just have walk-ons who don't say anything at all. But we were... The cringe factor in reenactment is truly scary, and I did not want to do bad cringe-making drama that took away from the works of art themselves.
Well, the Picasso thing begins with something rather dramatic and amusing. Did that actually happen?
Well, it's a story, visiting GI. It's certainly non è vero, ben trovato. It's said about Picasso. We'll never quite know. When, I think it was called Jerome Seclin, in fact, I'm pretty sure he does. He's a lefty worshipper of Picasso, a painter himself, and he goes and sees Picasso at the end of the war and says, is this true? And Picasso neither confirms nor denies it, which leads one to believe. I say very carefully in the script, a story made its way into the Picasso legend, which is certainly true. And Picasso loved it being told about himself, which is...
Well, you say that he was a non-political person, but...
Had been for a long time.
The Guernica, and then afterward winds up painting
He becomes a member of the Communist Party.
And hardly ever paints, at least according to my taste, a painting of anything near the worth of everything that preceded.
That's quite right. He fought, in my view, too. The most embarrassingly dismal thing he ever does is a sort of poster birthday card, literally for Stalin in 1953. It's just terrible, and everyone hated it. His old friends hated it.
Was that the dove?
Well, the dove is pretty dire too, but it's around the same time. No, it's a picture. It's almost a cartoonish picture of the great marshal himself. It's just unspeakably terrible. Do you like the charnel house? Because that's actually a sort of invertebrate version of... Yeah, I know. It all feels as though he's doing homework, you know, politically correct homework.
Or he's just going back and thinking about themes, whether they're his or Velázquez's or somebody else's. And
but those are better, Leonard, don't you think? At least actually when he gets rid of the Third International. I know they're not great. I say in that film, which got me into terrible trouble, that the rest of his life is the longest anticlimax.
Now, my staff wants me to have you tell the story, the Picasso story.
Oh, I should. That's staff, quite right. Well, the story is that, which it's certainly true, that the Milice Française, sometimes accompanied by Germans, go and turn his studio in the Rue des Grands Augustins on the left bank upside down every so often. And one day, the story is, a German officer comes in. And we know this also true. There are postcards of Guernica lying around. Guernica's already safely on tour in the United States and resting in New York. And so the German officer looks at it, points at it, and says to Picasso, did you do this? And Picasso said, no, you did. Go on, take one, souvenir. He was very puckish, it's fair to say. It's not atypical of him.
My guest is Simon Chama, whose series Power of Art is being broadcast on PBS on Monday nights. Last week, there were two episodes, Van Gogh and Pablo Picasso. Tonight, Caravaggio, mm-hmm. the great 17th century painter. And then Bernini next week, Rembrandt the week after, Jacques-Louis David, J.M.W. Turner on the 23rd, and Mark Rothko completes the series on July 30th. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Simon Sharma. The series that he has written and hosts is called Power of Art, and it is being broadcast on PBS Channel 13 here in New York on Monday nights. Tonight is the third installment. Sorry, I wasn't here last week to talk to him about the first two. And this is on Caravaggio. Now, one of the things that the show deals with is who pays for the art. And it changes over the years. There's a big difference between what happens when the Vatican commissions somebody to sculpt or paint and when the Four Seasons restaurant asks a contemporary painter to do a mural. So yes, can you want to, what happened with Rothko? Why did he react differently to what Michelangelo might have done or what Rembrandt might have done when asked to do something to paint something for money?
Well, Rothko really, in a way, is fictionalizing. That's actually probably not the right word. Rothko is being incredibly optimistic about what paintings in a restaurant might be able to do. I said a bit earlier on that I chose works that were self-consciously thought to be something other than ornamental. And, you know, Rothko came very late to success. He battled his way through some very turgid kind of neo-expressionist stuff before finding the great magic template of those beautiful throbbing panels of colour. And because he's there in the early 50s in New York, he has this love-hate relationship, not just with someone like a restaurant, but also his dealers. He was an obsessive control freak. What he wanted them to do, he didn't even want them being called abstract paintings. He was very influenced by chapels in Renaissance Italy and also Roman wall painting when he went to see those in Pompeii. He thought of his paintings as gathering together a kind of meditative space in which people would not be simply dissolved inside, utterly unlike Cranmer Greenberg's sense, in which paintings, all the paintings were a two-dimensional arrangement of colour. He wanted them to be a kind of moral, mystical journey, which would connect us with very elemental instincts, tragic ones. And he thought, well, what's the biggest challenge that could possibly be? People shoving foie gras down their mouths at the Four Seasons. He said famously to somebody he met on a cross-Atlantic journey, he said, I want to make those rich sons of bitches lose their appetite. So he's on a hiding to nothing, actually. But it's sort of...
But the painting doesn't wind up at the Four Seasons.
No, he never... He actually pulls the commission before... He goes to have a meal with Mel, his wife. And he comes back in a terrible rage and says, no one who pays that kind of money for that kind of food, he was famous for liking $5 Chinese takeaway, is going to look at paintings of mine. Now, we don't know whether the emphasis in that sentence is whether it's a sad descriptive sentence which suggests Rothko being resigned to the fact that he'll just be wallpaper, or whether he's ordering them out of the restaurant. But we do know that, you know, he gives a group of them, which have now been reinstalled very beautifully, you must go and see them, at Tate Modern, having not been installed very well. And that is a meditative space now, and his sort of dream came true with a little suite of them. There is actually planned an exhibition, you will love this, to reunite all the Seagram paintings from Japan, Washington, and London. I think it's designed for next year.
But it's odd that he would have said that. After all, the only people who can afford Rothko's, and even near the end of his life, the prices had gone up so high, were the people who ate at the Four Seasons.
Right.
What about Rembrandt, who was also an artist who relied very much on the merchants of his day to pay the bills?
Yes, I don't think Rembrandt really. I don't think he cares quite so much about what's going to happen to those paintings, unless they were, as in the case of the painting that we examine, unless they're public, meant to be seen by the public. The painting we deal with is The Oath of the Batavians, which was meant for the town hall and was commissioned from him after he's been bankrupt, and it was his comeback painting.
Now, what happened to him? He was a giant success, And then he fell out of favor, and then he had to do a comeback.
Well, he has. He does fall out of favor somewhat, because he's still doing these very kind of dark, intense, emotively loaded and pigment loaded paintings as well. But it has to be said that, you know, cited in the liquidation sale, basically the proceedings which declared him the equivalent of a bankrupt, were losses at sea. So, like a lot of wealthy burghers, you know, it's a period of dodgy naval war between the Brits and the Dutch, and we don't know how big those losses at sea were. He's overextended in his mortgage. The house is very, very grand. So the chronology about whether or not he's overextended because he's finding it difficult to get portrait commissions, which he is in the 1650s, compounded by this big business, his cargo going down, that's what does it. But then he's simply thought of as too difficult, stubborn. There are lots of cases where patrons complain that the portraits he's been commissioned to do are insufficiently good likenesses, and he has to...
He's making them look ugly.
Well, we don't know, but certainly he goes before a commission of his peers, which must have been intensely humiliating for a very proud person.
But he was also a contemporary of Vermeer's, wasn't he?
Vermeer's a little younger, but yeah.
But it's interesting to look at the work of these two artists who live in different parts of the Netherlands,
right,
but at relatively around the same time, the end of the 17th century,
right,
and who are so different.
Right. Well, different definitions of light, don't you think? I mean, Vermeer really paints everything inside, swimming inside a cube of irradiated light. For Rembrandt, lights are always interior. If you look at the light, if you go to Stockholm and see the fragment of that Claudius Civilis, the only light source is this kind of pond of burning brilliance that seems to swim on the table.
Now, you say the fragment, that's because he destroyed
it. He mutilated it, yeah. He sends this huge painting off to the town hall, and it's a story of the founding of the Dutch, mythically, in the Roman period, about a general who fought in the Roman army, but who was Batavian, and then goes native again and inspires a rebellion. Rembrandt has clearly read it in Tacitus, and Tacitus makes it a story of barbarian freedom. So Rembrandt paints it in the ferocious attack style. I mean, just absolutely astonishing kind of. And not surprisingly, it's sent back. It's rejected. And the only way that he can get a new buyer is to mutilate it, is to cut it down to the central portion of the figures, and that's what survives.
Well, many of the paintings you feature were controversial because of different aspects going against their cultures of the time. And Rembrandt's great inspiration was Caravaggio.
Yes,
the first artist of chiaroscuro that just took over the rest of the world, the art world in the 17th century.
Right.
Caravaggio really stuck it to everybody to the point where he literally stuck it to somebody.
He killed someone, yes, at Wimbledon, as it were, basically a sort of tennis match fight. Yes, he does. Well, Caravaggio, you see, I think even in Caravaggio's case, and he is a kind of tripwire, you know, he's a hair trigger psychotic in lots of ways. He's always looking for fights. But actually, Caravaggio is doing what the church wants him to do and is a huge success. The church says, we're fighting a war with the Protestants. The Protestants hate images. How can we make the most intensely compelling devotional images that celebrate Christ's life among the poor? So they're looking for somebody, which Correggio can't, you know, that tradition of sweetness can't quite do. Even the Caracci, who are thought of as being realist, don't go as far as Caravaggio in the kind of dirty feet, in-your-face, intense verismo of the sort of smell and the earthiness of the human figure.
Well, actually, he has almost two careers, doesn't he? The early works are all pretty boys. I would assume that many of his customers were people who wanted pictures of pretty men. And
well,
then later we have all of these, we have these paintings where Doubting Thomas is sticking his finger into Jesus' wound, and it's just one of the most shocking images.
Well,
and the one you have is really
shocking.
Well, he
goes from his pretty boy moment from the Cardinal del Monte to, you know, to paint the Contarelli Chapel for the Calling of Matthew, and that's the point where he's really broken through into the highest echelons of church commissions. And that's when he's listening, I think, to the theologians who are all saying the meaning of the incarnation is to give us bodies, bodies, bodies. So, you know, he does that like absolutely nobody else. The painting which traditionally was thought of as to be the one where he goes too far is The Death of the Virgin, where we know that someone commenting says he's just pulled a prostitute out from the river who's dead. And the point about The Death of the Virgin is that she isn't really dead. She's in dormition. She's in this kind of trance-like state before her translation to paradise. And what he does indeed is, in order, it's an amazing coup really, he wants to make the apostles are brought magically, as it were, to the bedside of the dying virgin, and he wants to make them stricken with grief. Well, why would they be stricken with grief unless they thought she had actually gone, she was actually immortal?
Now, so none of this would have worked if he weren't just such a great painter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Turner is one of the artists you include. Don't the British have more affection for Turner than people elsewhere? I mean, in the same way that Americans like Aikens?
Yes, I think that the great love-hate relationship is in France. I mean, every so often there are Turner shows. I remember going to see one on the Grand Palais, and it was as though they just discovered him. But, of course, actually in Monet actually was devoted to Turner and went to see him in London the first time round, and then was at pains to kind of repudiate his debt to Turner to say, oh, it's been exaggerated. But you kind of know it wasn't. So there is a... But I think that's true. I mean, Turner is buried in St. Paul's Cathedral. The British love to escape from the notion that they're all slightly Philistine literalists in their painting, and Turner gives them the poet many of them would always love to be.
Although this painting is Slave Ship.
Yeah.
So he is making a point here.
Oh, yes.
This
yes.
At the time of the great debate over slavery?
Well, it's actually in 1840 when there's an international convention of Americans and British, actually, addressed by Queen Victoria's husband, Prince Albert. And the world is waiting for a great painting. And what it gets with The Slave Ship is a kind of acid rock album cover, something so feverishly incoherent that everybody hates it. And when they have to choose a painting to give to Thomas Fowell Buxton, the leader of the abolitionist movement in Britain, they pass over Turner and choose a painting actually by a Frenchman called Billard. So although he's still very much the patriarch, everybody says he's lost it, he's senile, he's going crazy. That mattered to Turner because his mother actually was crazy, and Turner had committed her to a lunatic asylum. So this is his bad moment that we've chosen.
So you've picked an awful lot of artists who were in crisis of one sort or another. Rothko kills himself. Yeah. That's the way he ended his life. Turner was in crisis at this moment. Caravaggio was on the run from the law. Van Gogh was near suicide.
Right.
What about Bernini? Was he okay?
No. Tune in next week. Bernini, of course, is Mr. Fabulous and never seems to set a foot wrong. But actually, in this one moment, of course, actually, he commits a terrible crime. He's sleeping with the wife of one of his assistants, called Costanza Bonarelli, does an amazing sculpture. But she's also sleeping with his brother at the same time, Luigi. And he loses it and tries to kill his brother in St. Peter's, smashes his ribs to pieces with an iron bar, and then slashes his mistress's face. After that, things sort of go wrong for him. And his bell towers suddenly turn out to be structurally unsound, the one that's built, and the Pope orders them demolished. So this is the one moment in the life of otherwise impeccable Christian virtue and unbroken success where he comes a cropper.
And then we have Jean-Jacques David.
Jacques-Louis David, Jean-Louis,
The Death of Marat, which was hidden for 30 years and actually was the cause of his being refused burial in France.
Well, I think actually it was compounded by the fact that David, of course, has a post-revolutionary career of sucking up to Napoleon, being the kind of airbrush hagiographer of Napoleon, rather repellent thought. And he really goes for Napoleon during the Hundred Days. It's thought that you could maybe even get away with having been a regicide, but actually to sign on to Napoleon. So the combo of actually doing the Marat and being a kind of slavish devotee of Napoleon, when it was very imprudent to do so, was what condemned him to live out his days in Brussels. Not such a bad thing, actually.
And yes, but, I don't know if the restaurants were as good in those days.
They were pretty damn good.
But when you look at this list, these are all artists who may have had troubles during their lifetimes, but also had an incredible impact on all the art that followed.
Yes, yes. I mean, part of the point is that these, under the intense moment of difficulty, all these artists with the works that we're dealing then have a sort of knock-on effect. Not in all cases. I mean, no one quite sculpts like Bernini again, ever, really, until Rodin, I guess. I mean, Joshua Reynolds hated Bernini precisely because he was the magician who could make marble seem like flesh and do things that marble shouldn't do. But so mostly they are, yeah.
I was just going to, we're at the end of this, and I want to tell people that the show will be on tonight. Actually, you'll be able to see Michelangelo Marisa de Caravaggio coming up, all these other artists we've been discussing, every Monday night on Channel 13. My great thanks to Simon Sharma for talking about Power of Art.
It's a pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, a look at why so many lawsuits for damages due to mold have been lost recently. Then Andre Previn discusses his latest jazz recording, Scottish novelist Andrew O'Hagan on the life of a Catholic priest. And on Backstory, we find out why Albanians are so pro-American, plus what Congress's alternative energy bill will really do, who it will benefit, and what kind of impact it will have on the environment. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angela Sheldon, Fran Jacobs, Brad Ludlow, and Kim Gittleson. Jay Cowett was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.